From multiple fried locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are burnout and asynchronous and asymmetric input. So if everyone's ready, let's start.
That was a real dramatic pause. I love it.
Let's start. I'm just so used to Mark saying it.
Yeah. Yeah, we've changed the policy on that.
I think we did change that.
We did change the policy.
For the better, I think.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm used to it. I'm just feeling a little burnt out.
We're not ready for transitions yet. Not ready.
Shoot, okay. Right vibe, wrong time.
Yeah.
This is one tired clubhouse, I should say. Uh-huh. Ellen, you have a note here that we need to get to as a follow-up to a thing we were talking about in a previous episode.
Yeah, so also, this is now the meta, which I think Stephen explained to us in the last part of the previous episode as well. So I had mentioned, when was it? When was I talking about? Oh, working with family.
Yeah,
when Charles was on the show, I had mentioned that it would be super awesome to do some work with Eric, my husband, on game design and development, but we couldn't find a genre of games that we both enjoyed. We found a genre of games we both enjoy.
Oh,
so
what genre is that?
We're kind of really getting into co-op roguelikes.
Oh, okay.
So he's an avid roguelike player. He kind of chaining roguelikes over the past couple months, and I've been playing a few of them, and I like them. And we started a co-op game of Children of Morta.
Okay.
And it's pretty cool. Great art. Yeah. Great music.
Is there something that distinguishes a co-op roguelike from a roguelike other than another player?
I'm not sure. I'll ask Eric about that. But, I mean, you know, I think one thing that's different is, I mean, the items that you come across are randomly generated, of course. Mm-hmm. But if you have another person with you, then you're not always going to come across one and be like, well, that's a total waste. You know, if you're playing with someone who's a completely different class than you're playing, then it's more likely that you're actually going to get some utility out of that random drop.
Right. So, and you can, they get something cool, and emotionally that's just as rewarding as you getting something cool. Right.
If you're invested
in your partner's success. So I could see that like dulling some of the sharp edges of roguelikes, which keep me out of the genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a person who is sort of developing, well, not sort of, I've been developing a roguelike, you know, for almost 7 years, dear Lord, the game needs to come out. Fingence.
Yeah.
The one thing that I really like about Fingence specifically is that, like, it promotes teamwork
because
of the co-op roguelike nature of it. So, like, you can, I've never played Children of Morta, but I imagine, like, Ellen, you can serve a different role than Eric could. And so, like, you can do different things and feel, as a team, more, better than, like, if you were to, you feel more, like, more competent, I guess, at the game than if you were to play it by yourself, because, like, roguelikes are notoriously punishing.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Right, there's something about waving the banner, like the team banner.
Yeah.
Like, it's just as good as climbing the mountain by yourself or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in this game, so many roguelikes out there, and I think those that do have co-op components have different approaches to them. But this one, you're both playing characters that are available as player characters, so the balance of power between the two players is fairly equal. There's one lead player, and there's one, you know, support player.
Right. There's a Mario and a Luigi. I get it.
Yeah, but you're both acting independently, and you both have like the same breadth of skills. You just have really different skills. So we started playing with Eric playing as a tank, and I was playing the archer, because that's, I think, just the default characters you can start with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we played enough where we unlocked the kind of like the rogue character.
Ooh.
Who's like very emo teen kid, and the storyline's they put a lot of effort into the storyline, which is not, I didn't expect that from a roguelike so much. Like all these characters are all from the same like family, guardians of the forest family, so. Yeah. We switched it around a little bit, and then I played the tank, and he played the rogue. And so that's going to
The rogue is like teenager of Morta?
I'm not far enough to know who exactly the Children of Morse are.
Okay.
Yeah. Find out more to be revealed in a future episode.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in this household, all that's getting played is Civilization VI.
Like, yeah.
Dale.
For a few weeks now, right?
Listeners know is, yeah, just she's playing nothing but Civ 6 now. And I'm a little worried because the one more turn is a real illness. And she suffered to it. But it's also really fun because we've all been getting together every week to play a multiplayer game. And Dale has been, I wouldn't say dominating, but she's definitely playing smarter than most of us.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, she's took over most of the continent and has the largest standing army, the most cities, like the fastest production. We're all complaining about things, and she's like, it's not a problem for me. So,
right, these barbarians coming in with their swords and stuff, and Dale's got a nuke.
Yeah.
I saw that an age ago.
We all went to war against the Aztecs, and I had one unit. I'm like, Dale, can I join your army? And she's like, sure. And I'm like, what should I attack? And she's like, I don't care. I have it covered. And I'm like, okay, fine. I just want to be useful.
You go just hit that over there.
Yeah.
Good job here.
Yeah, good job. Well, okay. Take Ellen's transition from before, and put it here.
Is this? Are you? This is an instruction to the listener or to me, who's going to be editing this episode?
both of you? No, that doesn't make sense. Listener, pretend that transition was better.
Uh-huh.
we're talking about Burnout now.
This is maybe a good use case for Martha's stand-in transition.
Yeah, you know that topic. It's time for the next one. Hey.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to talk about Burnout because it is a thing that, you know, I think everyone experiences this at a point in their career.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to talk about it. So, Alan, you posted this World Health Organization link that they have a definition of burnout, which is, valuable. It's an official definition defined in the ICD-11. I don't know what that is, but it sounds important. burnout is a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. It is characterized by three dimensions: feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job or feelings of negativity or cynicism related to one's job, and reduced professional efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
In relation to like video games, this comes up quite a lot because, the AAA developers and some indie developers are notoriously forcing employees through crunch. And so like they'll constantly be working through things. And eventually you get to the point where you've been working so hard for so long that like you start to feel these effects. You start to feel burnout. And so I wanted to talk about how burnout is like expressed in a human's body and like why it happens and like maybe some of the burnout that we've experienced and maybe some ways you can deal with it if there's anything you can do about it. I mean, I think a lot of people when it comes to burnout in the industry, they oftentimes just leave the industry and go somewhere else,
right,
where they feel better treated. This is like, I guess this is more of a systemic issue with all of these things, not just like burnout, but just, you know, there's a lot of things that we can improve upon in the game industry. And so like we could talk about those at length, I suppose, but like, I guess I want to talk about it from like a microscopic level. What can me, say as an example, do to help myself or other people deal with burnout, is what I was trying to approach it. But, moving back a little bit, I just wanted to talk about like, what does it mean to feel burnout? Have you felt like you've experienced burnout in the past?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Ellen, do you want to describe a little bit about like what that felt like, or maybe how it came to be?
I feel like I keep doing it to myself, which is a character flaw. I first felt burnout after I started in teaching.
Okay.
Because teachers, especially early tenure teachers or non-tenure teachers, but teachers who are early in their career, they work a ton.
Yeah.
And it's stressful because they haven't built up the support network in their school districts yet that older teachers have. They haven't built up relationships with families that long-term teachers have. And they don't have good professional boundaries, and they haven't built their curriculum yet. Yeah. So they're completely started from scratch. The other thing that tends to happen is new teachers are expected to step forward and do extracurriculars.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I did all those things, and it was really tough. And I was also in a very rural district where there really wasn't a place to live. So I wasn't living in a proper home.
Oh, wow.
With a proper kitchen. So I was basically living on burritos and Monster.
Oh.
Do not recommend.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at, if you just try to take that and kind of generalize it, it kind of keeping in mind what the World Health Organization was telling us, you can look at kind of all those factors. Like it was lots of working hours every week, kind of endlessly.
Yeah.
Consistent and just endless. Not great sleep schedule, not great nutrition, not great activity because of all the hours I was working, kind of a shaky support network, I guess would be one.
Sure.
But I think the biggest thing is also this feeling of lack of control, because that feeling of just like endless exhaustion, that you mentioned in the description.
Yeah.
If you feel control over how much of that exhaustion you're going to take on, then when you feel like it's getting to be too much, you say, okay, I'm taking a vacation.
Right.
I'm going to take a day off. I'm going to try something else. But if you're in a position where you feel like you are trapped to your commitment, you're completely tied in with your commitment, you can't break it or you can't take any time away, then there's really no relief.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that might be a factor.
Yeah.
And I've done that to myself. After I left teaching and went into instructional design, I did that to myself too. So it's not just the industry you're in. You also have to look at your personal tendencies to overcommit.
Yeah.
Well,
let me ask you, like, because I also have switched careers and found that the things that that led me to burnout in one reared its head again in another. And I don't know that I was surprised necessarily, but let me ask you, like, did you feel like when you started seeing those things happen to you again, were you like shocked or were you like, oh, of course? Like, did you think that you were going to leave a lot of that behind with teaching? Because I think when people like move away from something that they either have lost the passion for, or it's an unhealthy environment, or it's not the right thing for them, and they move to somewhere else, it's easy to think that all the bad things you left behind all the bad things.
Yeah. No, I definitely think that you got me. I think that I did at that point.
Yeah.
When I left teaching, I thought that leaving that industry would, or calling, or however you want to describe it, would free me from those dynamics, which I think I'm pretty sensitive to.
Yeah.
And it didn't. Those dynamics are present wherever people need things to be done, frankly.
Yeah,
And so when it happened to me another time, I realized that it wasn't necessarily the field I was in or the role I was in. It was really that I liked to push myself really hard and to make sure that I was mindful of my levels of stress and give myself permission to not do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did something similar where, I was in indie film and video editing. That was sort of my passion, my career and my hobby was sort of everything. And then I moved into games and I took a lot of those skills and talents and even freelance work with me. So it's sort of like blended, but the one thing that changed in my life was the different communities I was a part of. So like the indie film community, the people who work on independent projects and who share jobs with each other with commercial clients. And so it's a professional and social environment, very similar to like our local indie dev community, right? It's just a different field. And the thing that when I got really, really it became a bad situation for me because I was providing a lot of sort of support, like emotional support, which we all were for each other.
Yeah.
But ultimately, because of like my particular set of expertise, I was called on to do that and nothing else. And so it became everyone's had a job where like they can't grow. And mm-hmm. that is something that I found, but it was my friends who were, they were staffing for music videos and yeah. there weren't a lot of editors and there were almost no animators. And so I only ever got to do that. And so it was very frustrating for me, and it wasn't anybody's fault, right? But it was a situation mm-hmm. that led to a lot of burnout because I felt less and less invested in projects. I felt less like this project would matter to me going forward. I stopped adding things to my reel because it's like, who cares? I have enough of this. And so it got really, really frustrating. And I realized, well, if I'm not going to have a different kind of professional relationship with a lot of these people, this is fine. I needed to move away, and I didn't feel a lot of the sort of support, that community support that you were mentioning. That I felt like, oh, there's not enough of that here. And that's leading to a lot of my problems. I moved into the game dev community where the community I found a lot better. Partly because our game jam environments are a lot more, the culture around them is different. And everything I was missing and unhappy about with that community, which was not related to any particular people, but there's just the structure of it. All of that was better in indie dev. Just all of it was better. And I think I overestimated what that would do for me because I have a lot of the same feelings of frustration and burnout in games. And it shouldn't surprise me because it's not that you know what I mean? Maybe I put too much, Ellen, like you were saying, like there's the things you thought you left behind or the things that you didn't expect to come back again. And then you're like, well, wait, what is causing this then? I thought I diagnosed it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that can be like, oh, and then you can, this sort of feelings of hopelessness, or it can be really, really difficult. Right. And I think that, I don't know if that's unique necessarily to situations that Ellen and I are describing where it sort of, something comes back around, but it can be a special kind of loss when it happens again, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, because you felt like you moved away from it.
Yeah,
because you thought that
like, oh, I did the work. I got better. It's like I learned something. And maybe it turns out you didn't learn that much after all.
Yeah.
Right.
Honestly, that's kind of what I'm feeling now a little bit too.
Yeah.
Because I think I've been feeling some burnout at work. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of it is, I mean, I think a lot of people are probably experiencing some form of burnout right now anyways, because, you know, we're all in quarantine. We're still in quarantine. And the isolation might be getting to people,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's a lot of things have been happening in the news and stuff, and it is
right.
A lot. I know people have been saying this for like years that a lot of things have been happening in the news, and it's a lot. But like, I don't know. I think it's all like hitting me more now, and maybe part of that is just because I'm by myself, so I can't really express how I'm feeling about it as easily,
mm-hmm.
because I'm just sitting by myself. Oh boy, this is turning into a rant. That's fine.
It's your platform.
It is. but at any rate, like I've talked a little bit about like my experience when I went up to Duluth to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much I've expressed it on the show, but I could do a little bit of that here. I originally went to school for mechanical engineering at Twin Cities campus, University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And I flunked out because like I didn't do well in classes and stuff, and like I had friends and things, but like I just didn't pay attention to my studies. And so my dad kind of pulled some strings because he went to the Duluth campus, and he got me to go to the Duluth campus. That's where my brother was going too. And what I experienced there was really more. I mean, it was a burnout because I guess I was still a student, so I guess I could have experienced burnout as a student. But I think it was really more of a form of depression.
Where like Ellen's I just like, are you sure?
Getting that right, because Ellen, you went to Duluth. You went to the Duluth campus. You had a great time, right?
Well, I was mostly just cocking in my head at the idea that you can't experience burnout as a student.
Oh yeah, you can't. You totally can't experience burnout as a student. Okay. I don't think I was experiencing the kind of burnout that we're talking about.
Okay.
Like, yeah, I know that. Like, yeah. But At any rate, like, I was up in Duluth, and I felt a form of isolation, because, like, all the friends and stuff that I had were all in the Twin Cities. My family and stuff was in the Twin Cities. I didn't really know anybody up in Duluth. I feel like this kind of just in general, just because of, like, the, you know, group of people that tend to be around, but, like, I do tend to feel like I'm, like, the only Black person in most circles. There is, like, a Black student association up at UMD, but, like, I didn't feel connected to them at all.
Right.
And so, like, really, I only had my brother as, like, a person I could talk to. There was, I don't think we've ever had Lizzie on the show, but, like, Lizzie, who used to work at Pixel X where I work, she was a person who was, like, trying to get people together to make games and stuff. And so, like, that helped me out a lot, because that was, like, basically the only thing I could look forward to every week. But in any rate, I basically felt like I didn't have any energy to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was just kind of stuck up there. The one thing I was able to have energy for was making games. And so thankfully I was able to, you know, I worked on Fingence while I was up there, and that helped me, you know, and then I had, like, a job in the Twin Cities campus, or in the Twin Cities, because, like, I was working on the weekends. And so, like, I was able to do some stuff, and, like, that job helped me get the job that I have now. That job has Fingence, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm starting to feel that sense of isolation and stuff too here.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, a lot of it is probably because I'm in quarantine and I just don't get mm-hmm. to socially interact with people. Mm-hmm. But, like, it also feels weird because, like, now I'm starting to feel social anxiety where I don't want to interact with people. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like the what you're describing now in isolation, as well as, like, your time in Duluth, because you're not describing that as you being so under pressure that it's burnout. But I think what you're describing is the bar for that, it just lowers, right? It's easier to get overwhelmed and exhausted, even under, like, what you would in other times call a normal set of stressors.
Yes.
Right.
Well, yeah, actually, that's a very good point, because, like, I was doing all of the same stuff I was doing before, but I didn't feel this form of exhaustion
mm-hmm.
That I have been. It's really felt like exhaustion towards work specifically.
Mm.
Like, I do a lot of things. Like, I do Nice Games Club. I'm still working on Fingence. I do a bunch of stuff. But I still have, I have less enthusiasm for all those things, too, to be honest. Except Nice Games Club. We're great.
Steven.
I'll be honest, a little bit of that too, just because I felt exhaustion.
But I should say, and this should go to, like, for people who are working on projects together with friends or with people you're close to or who you believe, like, it's okay to be a little bit less motivated, and it's okay to talk to your collaborators about that.
Yeah.
Right? You shouldn't feel like, you know, Steven, you know, he's joking, but then he said, like, a little bit, like, he can trust us with that revelation. Yeah. And I think hopefully the people in your life who you're intertwined with, you can trust them with that as well.
I can. And that's that's what feels great about, actually, that's a lot of it, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like, I feel pretty well supported in all the other jobs I work at, except for my main job.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, like, I like that definition that the WHO posted about burnout, because, like, it feels pretty accurate. I don't have much of a support system at work, or at least I don't have easy access to a support system at work. I guess I had a better support system before, because, like, we were all in contact.
Right.
It's much harder to get in contact with people now about stuff. And so I don't feel as well supported. And so, like, it doesn't feel like it's worth my time to work on work stuff more now.
It's not as personally rewarding.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like the right phrase, but I know what you
mean. But that's kind of what it is. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think that's what it really is, like, that kind of stuff. And what so, like, that's... go ahead.
You're working from home, and so when you think of time devoted to work, you're taking time that you're spending at home and giving it to work.
Mm-hmm. So
that might be a big part of it, is that...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When you say it's not worth it, it's because if you get home late and you bring some work home with you, that can feel exhausting and not worth it. And it just, incidentally, that's what every day feels like, even if you haven't started work yet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that is how it feels. Like,
I think a lot of people feel that way working from home, either for the first time or for not a lot of experience with that.
Right. Yeah, and I don't have a lot of experience work. Like, Mark, you do this. You work from home regularly. You have a better understanding of, like, that kind of
work. I'm all the way off the deep end with this. So it's not like it's a it's a coping mechanism, not a skill.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. I mean,
Stephen, you've seen Mark's chair, right?
Yeah. That's true. That's
very true. Yeah. He's all in.
He knows what's up.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, you were saying before the show that you've noted that I have a tendency to, like, if I am exhausted, I will power through till it's finished on a project or a thing or whatever. And that has been very beneficial. And part of it is because I don't have the same concept of time or space that most people do.
Okay. Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about, like, working setups, right? A couple episodes back. But definitely it's a case where I will ignore those signs for very long because I have to, because I, by nature, my career and the work I do on my own has always required that flexibility that now people are being faced with. And so I would like to be able to offer advice on how to manage things like that. But, like, it's just, I don't know, struggling under it for years is all you can do.
Well, practice.
Yeah. You've grown accustomed to it, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. It's comfortable for me. Yeah. In a way.
And so, yeah, you're right. Like, it does feel like I have to actively, like, push myself to start doing work more. Like, when I would travel to work and be it, like, then I'm at work. And so, like, I mean, part of it is, like, I don't have access to all of the other things I normally have access to when I'm at home. But the other part of it is, like, you know, I'm in a completely different place and all the other people around me are doing work. So, like, if I'm not doing work socially, you're, you know, and you're, like, exiling yourself, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, like, I don't have that pressure. So, like, it's more difficult for me to do it. But I am starting to think more and more that, like, I'm missing that support system that I used to have at work. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting that as much anymore.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
I think that this is something that is experienced by a lot of people. In their different careers, I think that, like, if it doesn't feel like your company you're working for or the group you're working for or whatever has your best interests at heart, it can start to feel like you're wasting your time working on this thing. And then it can also start to feel like it's not the company that's the problem. It's, like, the whole industry that might have this issue. And, like, there may be some issues in the industry that have this problem, but, like, it starts to just feel like all of the choices you made are not the right choices, I guess.
Yeah. It's normal to feel burnout. I guess this is my message to any listeners who might be working through these kinds of things right now, is it's normal to feel burnout. That's not, that doesn't mean that there's something, like, fundamentally wrong with you.
Yeah.
You know, we've mentioned over the last 10 minutes or so kind of different dynamics that come into a workplace or, you know, an institution that can contribute to burnout.
Right.
And then also, of course, like, you might be more sensitive to those dynamics and get burnt out faster. There's no right threshold for that. Like, you have to respect your own limits. I am not going to be able to run, like, Usain Bolt. Like, and that's cool. I have to respect my own limits as an athlete. That's a laughable term right now. I don't think I've gone to the gym has been closed for months. So anyway, I'm never going to swim like Michael Phelps. Like, that's fine. I do my own things well.
Yeah.
But, you know, gotta respect your limits. And if you can push yourself, great. Also respect yourself if you feel like you can't.
Yeah.
The other thing to remember, I think, is that if you are mentally tired, you will be less productive. And then you will, be careful to push yourself when you're super tired, because you will be less productive. And then you'll have to push yourself more because you're being less productive and you'll get more tired.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just better to take a break. It took me a long time to get to that point, but I had, and still have the pleasure of working with this person, a really great project manager, actually a lot of really great project managers, who I could say, you know, when I was working in the design space, I could say, hey, I know I need to do this. I just don't have the mental fortitude to do this writing right now or to do this design right now. Like, I need to go to bed. I need to just like check out for the next several hours and I'll do a little bit earlier tomorrow morning. And usually that was fine. It's just the communication piece.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's the case for you, Stephen, but that has worked for me, is communicating about that, communicating about that and asking for reasonable accommodation, like asking to say, hey, I've been working for 50 hours a week for the last 3 weeks and I need some time off.
Yeah.
That is not unreasonable. It is a reasonable request.
Right. Totally is.
Yeah. It's that support system that you're talking about, that Ellen's describing, a good example of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And like, I have like, mental support systems outside of work and at work, frankly, but like, I don't have a lot of like, it doesn't feel like I could go to my boss or supervisor and say, hey, I'm having a hard time with this kind of thing. I need more time because of like just the way things feel. But like, I like all of that you just said, Ellen, was wonderful. I'm glad you said all that stuff because I think that like, it's important for people to know that like, you know, you're not broken because you're starting to feel some form of burnout in your career choice.
It's something that
everyone experiences. And I think that like, I guess I want to talk about like you were talking about, Ellen, I want to talk about some ways that like you can try to deal with it or try to, you know, improve the situation for yourself as best you can. I mean, it's difficult because like at the end of the day, your company or whoever you're working for, you know, needs you to get something done. Even if it's just a group, even if it's just yourself, you need to get something done. And so like you have to figure out strategies to help yourself get through this period, you're experiencing. I wanted to ask y'all like what you have done in the past to help you go through it.
Mark, do you want to go first?
No.
Mark's answer is more caffeine.
Well, I mean, it is difficult because a lot of what burns me out is like my own expectations. And I'm super good about estimating how long something's gonna take. Like I overwork myself, but wait, what, Ellen?
I was like, it's the Holy Grail, the guy who can estimate.
When you've been freelancing this long with fickle clients, like you eventually figure it out. You know where the wiggle room is, you know where to overestimate, you learn it. You're never perfect at it. But so what I mean to say is that when I'm putting the pressure on myself, it's not so much about getting this much of work done in this time. Yeah. It's more like what the work, like being satisfied with the work, right? Sure. And so whether that means like that this is good enough for the standards I've set, or if it's a game, that this is selling enough, or that this is getting enough attention, or for a nice games club that like our download numbers moving up at a rate that I'm happy with. Because what I tend to feel is like there's a lot of effort you need to put in to keep things the way they are. And I very frequently will put more effort and more effort and more effort, and then I won't see the kinds of, I mean, results is not the right word for it, but like I won't feel better about having put more work into it. I'll be very frustrated at like, well, why did I bother? And independent of like the pride in the work itself or the stress that the work caused me, because like I was mentioning, like I can power through a lot and I can ignore those signs. And it can be very helpful because I can get tired and fall asleep later. But like I don't suffer through that a lot. So I feel lucky in a sense that but then I get very emotionally attached to the value of the work. Am I describing this kind of, I think it relates to a thing for a lot of game devs where when you finish a project is when a lot of people feel the most burnt out, when you no longer have anything to do. And that's happened to me on films I've worked on where I did all this work to like put together the, and it's like a, it's a 13 minute short film, right? It's not, you know, I'm not building the Tower of Babel, and, and I get all of it done, but in order to make good on the work, I now need to submit to festivals and I need to start working on the next project. And I need to, you know, I need to do a lot. I need to build the web, like just anything. Games are the same thing, right? There's more than just the work. There's the supporting work. And you can find yourself being, even if you organize things well, you find yourself suddenly being like really demotivated to do the final steps to give the work value in the world, independent of the work itself. And so this happened to me on Widget Satchel where, you know, I finished Widget Satchel and then I immediately didn't care about it. Like, immediately, not that I thought any of it was a waste of time. Not that I thought any of the work wasn't good. I suddenly just didn't care anymore. And it was, and I, that I had to do that because otherwise it would be very crushing emotionally. Because like I won't really get into it, but the week Widget Satchel launched was a terrible week for me, like personally. Like I lost a lot of things and it was a really bad week. And so I had to shut myself off and say like, okay, like I can't care. And some it was some of that like that emotional satisfaction of doing the work. Like I think we talked about on the show before, like we didn't expect Widget Satchel to sell a copy, right? I think we were at a pretty healthy idea about that. So I never had any emotion tied to its success in the market, right? I think for all of us, it was a portfolio piece. We all were hoping it would do well, and I think by that standard, it did fine. But I had to shut myself off in that moment, and then what followed was a long period of not being able to do much at all. And so it is interesting because burnout is really about like overworking yourself. I mean, that's the with the clinical definition. But I see it in game developers. It's talked about a lot in the moment when you're after you're done. That it happens a lot, right? And but it's the it is the same. It's the same feeling. You go through the same stuff. But suddenly you don't have those demands on you, or maybe it's about you can't work on the next project or whatever. But I guess I'm just trying to I'm rambling now. But I'm trying to reconcile the contradictions.
Yeah.
It's like an emotional vacuum.
Does that make sense? Like Steven, how did you feel after Treasure Stack came out? Because that was you had a rough launch. You had to like push out some bug patches. How did you feel? Do you have a similar sense of burnout when that game was done?
I didn't know, but I wasn't very emotionally attached to.
Okay, because it wasn't your design.
Yeah, and so
it was like, a lot of your hard work. I mean, that game.
I worked on it.
Yeah.
But like it didn't. I wasn't as attached to it because it wasn't my design.
Yeah.
And like. It kind of felt like Treasure Stack was the cause of a lot of drama in the job.
So you were happy to see it out the door.
Honestly, I was kind of at that point. So I didn't experience that form. I didn't really experience it. It was more of a relief. It was like, oh, I can finally not feel as stressed out about this because, you know, it's finally out the door, even though there were all these bugs and stuff I had to fix. It didn't feel that way to me.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's a sign of a, like, you know, you say like there's drama at work related to it, but like you didn't really crunch near the end, right? You probably worked a little hard to get things done as a deadline.
But
it seems like you had a healthy relationship to that work.
Yes.
And then what happened after? Like, what were the next, once that patch went out? Was it a lot lighter workload? Was it a relief or was did it
it was kind of a little bit I think it was a bit more of a lighter workload because like we weren't like, you know, really pressured to make sure that the game was coming out at a certain date. We just kind of, you know, released it when we were ready. It felt like, and like it got ready in a reasonable or quick enough time where it didn't feel like we were slow, and so like that felt good. But like it was also, what was nice about that is like for a little while, it was kind of just experimentation. Like, I just got to mess around with what would eventually become Rhythm Rumble. And things. And so, like, that felt good. Like, I felt like I was able to, like, try to do some things that, like, I wanted to do.
Yeah. That's a good strategy, I think, when you have that feeling of, like, moving on from a project, is to take, a work vacation where you get to play with the next idea. if you have the luxury to be able to do that, and you had the support system in your day job to be able to play with the next idea, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And so that was good. So that's an avenue that like could help with that, is like find something that you're more excited to do and like work on that, or find something different that you want to work on.
Right. A treat, a reward for having put in all the time.
Because you know you've done a good job.
You deserve
a reward. And the reward is, I guess, more work, but it's different work.
Yeah.
You know?
That's counts. That's totally valid. Oh, yeah.
It is a vacation from what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Ellen, you're the work you're doing now at work, you've said you're pretty emotionally invested in. But are there past projects where you had that involvement, that, how did you feel when those were out the door?
Oh my God.
Like, were you ready to go to the next thing?
Gosh, I don't even know if I can remember. Maybe that means I wasn't. I'm not sure. Well, yeah, I think I was, for like some of the longer projects I have been on. Like, there was one example that was like, I worked on mostly software training for like a year.
Yeah.
So, and it's not like sexy software. This wasn't software designed by Adobe. This was like some custom system that someone back in the 90s made for the big company, and it's way too expensive for them to update it and change it. So instead, they'll just spend a lot of money on it. So like 12 months of writing software training.
Yeah.
I think I wasn't very emotionally invested in that work, for one, right? So it didn't really burn me out because I wasn't putting a whole lot of myself into it.
Yeah.
Even though I was putting a lot of hours into it,
right,
I wasn't putting a lot of myself into it.
Yeah.
You know what it sounds like? It sounds like the there's a metric, there's like a to use some kind of metaphor, you have like, you can fill the bucket with something, and you can fill it with time, difficulty, workplace drama, or emotional investment. But eventually it will overflow. And that's maybe what's the commonality between all these types of experiences that we've shared, is that eventually it overflows. It's not any one thing that will cause it.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's dynamics between several different things.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, feeling, I think the thing that has contributed to some periods of burnout in my work as a learning experience designer is, you know, working for a firm. Once that thing ends, there's another thing right lined up for you.
Yeah.
You know? So I have learned that what is best for me, and therefore best for my career, best for my practice. And I think I'm a pretty good learning experience designer. So like, overall, probably best for like it's an overall positive for learners and like the industry and the things I'm involved in, is it's best in the long term if I don't let my bucket overflow.
Yeah.
So if that means that I have to take like some time regularly to just stop and dump some of the bucket out, like, I have given myself permission to do that, instead of just pushing through until whatever feels like, whatever I'm working on feels done. Like, I've shifted my perspective from a series of projects that get done to a long-term career that's ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And that has enabled me to say no more.
Yeah.
And that has been a pretty healthy shift. So now, like, I'm, you know, working a lot on something that I am emotionally invested in. I don't feel burnt out because I know, like, okay, yep, this week was tough, but I know this next week will be better. And I'm going to do this to make sure that I'm managing my stress and my workload and so on and so forth, leaning on my support network and just being honest. And that has really, really helped. And so it's a need, all that I've learned, I've learned about myself, that I need to take time, learned that I need to say no, learned that I need to explicitly ask for support. I feel like I've finally got to a place where I'm actually able to put it into practice. And so, it's the long-term perspective, right? So
those are the strategies that Stephen was asking about, right?
Yeah.
But the trick is that you're able to use those things to empty a little bit of the bucket. But Stephen, as you're describing your work environment and the like, the issues I'm facing, we have different tools, fewer or of a different number or shape or size than Ellen has to empty the bucket. And so But what Ellen describes is a little suite of tools that not just one. You laid out a couple that can be really helpful for, I think, a lot of people. So I think that's pretty valuable, but it's not going to solve everybody's problem in all cases.
Right.
It's not.
And I think this is why everybody talks about brainstorms on what to do, because it's hard to define. It's hard to diagnose. And
every situation is different.
Yeah.
I mean, it manifests itself in different ways, but it's also like a different situation for every person.
Right. Right.
Just because you're experiencing burnout does not mean you're experiencing burnout for the same reason.
Yeah. But I think a lot of what Ellen said, I think, Stephen, you can take some of that directly to the things you're feeling and can probably help you a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, that is helpful. Thank you.
Okay. No, I got this, Stephen. I got this. Let me do this one.
Go for it.
Okay. So we were talking about how everyone's experienced burnout, right? And maybe that some of our listeners have more ideas to share, or they maybe want to talk to the community about, some more strategies and techniques for dealing with that stuff. So is there a place that people can go to do that?
I don't know. We better make one quick.
Yeah. Okay. I'll really quick go on Discord and type it up. Oh, we got it. We got it.
Nice game. Look at that. It's nicegames.club/discord.
Oh, wow. So is this like a whole Discord server with like tons of channels and a lot of rules?
It doesn't sound like us.
No. It's definitely not that. No, we have a channel on the Twin Cities Game Dev Discord. We've created for our listeners to communicate with us and people in the community. So if you have input about the topic burnout or other topics that we've talked about a lot of topics, y'all. please come to our Discord. You can go to nicegames.club/discord.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right. Well, one at a time, we make it to the second topic here. Asynchronous and asymmetric gameplay. That's the best transition I can offer. I'm sorry.
It was good.
All right.
It's
thanks.
Kind of obscure. I saw what you were going for.
I'm feeling supported in this work environment. Okay, so this is I didn't just combine these because they sound the same. There's a method to this madness. So
okay,
I think a lot of people know what these terms mean, but I'll just lay them out. So asynchronous gameplay is these are both usually for multiplayer type games, but multiple players not playing at the same time. Very often it's competitive multiplayer, but you're not playing at the same time someone else is playing. So I make a move and then you make a move whenever you've got time, right?
Yeah.
But essentially any turn-based game works this way, even if you're sitting at a table together. But generally, correspondence chess by mail. This is what people think of as, Words with Friends is a more modern example. So that's asynchronous gameplay. Asymmetric gameplay is basically when you have multiple players who are doing different things. So they're not engaging with the same gameplay systems. Very frequently, it is still asymmetric and asynchronous, but especially in a lot of video games, it's real time and asymmetric. So these do connect or they combine in some cases. But the reason I want to talk about them together, it changes multiplayer mechanics, right?
Yeah.
And that's what they share in common, is that it's multiplayer mechanics where players operate independently. So if it's asynchronous, it means they're operating independent of time. And if it's asymmetric, they're operating independent of mechanic. And so I think there's that's what I think connects them a little bit. I think
that's a good description of it. I like that.
Yeah. And I do want to think about when we do some of these topics, it's really valuable to sometimes think of two that go together, because I don't think people talk about it a lot. I think about people talking about, I'll list these examples of asymmetric games. Like, you know, I have a couple of here. So Spy Party is one where one person is the spy and the other person is the assassin. You know, there's a Werewolf is an example. There's a party game where it's asymmetric gameplay. Evolve is a video game that didn't do great, but had a great asymmetric concept where you had like four hunters and one monster. Right. Yeah. And so the it has a real different experience, because sometimes, I mean, like if you like tag is asymmetric, right? Like one person's it. But like, I think video games have, there's some video game concepts that allow for wildly different experiences. And I think that is really interesting. But what that means is that those players are playing different games, right?
Yeah.
And so and that I think has a similar kind of feeling as a designer, as something that is asynchronous, where maybe the same mechanics, but the players are not interacting, right? They're not, the mechanics do not involve direct interaction in a sense. It's act and react. And so I think there's something there to connect them in terms of like thinking as a designer, how you want to come up with new ways to do this. And I think it's, so if you want to make a game that's either of these two types, that's fantastic. But I think you can use these concepts in games that are not wholly one or the other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that in terms of asymmetric gameplay, I think it's more challenging because of the reason you brought up, Mark. Mm-hmm. You're effectively making two mini games that like one player is dealing or one player is doing and another player is not doing.
Yeah.
But they have to communicate in some form or fashion to make a full cohesive game. And so that makes it more complicated. But I think that like maybe you can use asynchronicity to like make that form of gameplay easier to design or balance around.
Mm-hmm. One of the things asynchronous gameplay does is it slows down a game.
Yeah.
So the sort of example is a correspondence chess is, you know, there are tournaments for correspondence chess. And you're like, how is that just different from chess except slower? But the slower is really important, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people who regularly like as a hobby play correspondence chess will have dozens or hundreds of games going at once. And so, but not only that, there are rules that are similar to chess, but like in terms of like a turn limit, right? One of the things that makes chess challenging at high level play, a tournament play, is the clock, right? You have a certain amount of time for all your moves. And so and as the game gets longer, if you waste the time earlier, you need to think faster later, and then that compromises your reasoning ability, right? So correspondence chess, when the limit of snail mail from the person I'm playing halfway around the world, you know, in 1950 or whatever, is it's 30 days. If we're playing regulations correspondence chess, it is a totally different thing. You can just at your leisure, you can just like map out the next 30 moves and strategize, and other players can do different things with all that time. And so I think that's really interesting. Or something like Words with Friends is, you know, it's correspondence Scrabble, and you can look up definitions. You can test out all your different, you can take your tiles and you could test out spellings in a way that if you did it in Scrabble, people would be like tapping their watch and be like, get on with it.
Right.
Or it's just verboten by the rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it changes, it's not just a convenience measure, right?
Yeah.
It changes a lot. And then that makes, and if people play in different fashions, that ultimately makes the game asymmetric. Because if I'm playing my correspondence chess, like I play a normal chess game, and I'm playing six matches or something over time, but I'm not thinking linearly, I'm just thinking about in the moment, because I just got this, your turn, but I was playing somebody else yesterday, so I'm not thinking about the continuity of yours. Mm-hmm. That's a different game than maybe you're playing, where you're focused on this one game, and you do like hours of research every month to plan the move, right?
Right.
Yeah, I suppose that is true. And I like what you brought up about like asynchronous slowing down the pace of a game, because like sometimes that is important. Like we should have an episode on pacing in a game,
because
that's like a topic in itself that we should go over. Like sometimes games need to be a little bit slower paced in order for the player to really feel that flow or get into the moment of whatever is happening. And so, like, I think that, like, asynchronous in a multiplayer game, this is a method that you can use to slow down a person's movement. Now that I think about it, like, I'm thinking about the difference between, like, Anno 1800, mm-hmm. which is a real-time game that's kind of like Civilization, where, like, you know, you're building your cities and stuff, and you can try to compete with others to build, get their islands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Civilization 6 is, you know, turn-based. And so, like, those, you can see the difference between those two. Like, in Civilization 6, you can feel like, it feels like you can think out your turns, and it doesn't feel as pressured to make decisions. But because of that, like, everybody is kind of, like, on the top of their game as far as their understanding of the game works.
You can play, like, optimally if you have the patience to play optimally, right?
Well, yeah. Well, not just that, but, like, you can play optimally up to your skill level.
Right. Yeah,
if that makes sense.
I'm definitely not playing Civilization optimally, even when I'm playing it at my best.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but as you get a better understanding of Civilization and stuff, your optimal turn will, you know,
my capacity.
Ellen optimal, right?
Yeah.
Right. Whereas, like, in Anno, because it's real time, there's more things that happen that can because it's much more faster paced, you have to quickly make decisions. And so you can't, like, if something bad happens, you can't think about, like, how you're going to deal with it, because, like, other bad things can happen while you're sitting there thinking about stuff.
Right. Mechanically, the game rewards instinctual thinking or like a good working knowledge of the rule set. Whereas in Civilization, I'm free to check out that wiki at any time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, honestly, Anno is not, like, super fast paced, but, like, it is faster than Civilization because of that real time element.
Yeah,
you can't sit there and think about things all the time. You have to make decisions. You have to make them quickly. And, like, it doesn't punish you. I think, generally speaking, it doesn't punish you so much that, like, you are doomed if you make any bad decisions. But, like, you know, you got to make them. You still have to make decisions quickly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the reason I wanted to talk about these together, another reason is because the definition can be kind of fuzzy. Because I was thinking about asymmetry in terms of, like, motivations and not just mechanics. As a designer, I really like games where the controller's the instrument, where the rules are simple, and where everybody has the same tools, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll ever make a game that is class-based. Like, I mean, you know, famous last words, but, like, I'm not really motivated to do that. Because I like a game like chess, right? Where it's wits against wits, right? Or reflex against reflex. And so, thinking about, still finding a way to make those types of games asymmetric in terms of motivation, in terms of goals, in terms of situational asymmetric. So, you know, there are lots of, shooter games that are like this, like capture the flag modes where, you know, it, suddenly you're the defending team or whatever, right? But even though you're all essentially given the same tool set. And thinking about Metro Nexus, which is a game where I'm making, where it's a real time game. It's arcade paced, right? It's a real time multiplayer competitive single screen battle game, and it's, you know, you don't need to know many more about that for this concept. But the criteria by which you win a match is sort of up to players, so it just keeps a lot of data. So you decide whether, you know, lives or points or whatever mattered more. And that's a fun gimmick for the game. But it means that at any point in the game, you could be working at different goals than other players, and they can change at any time. So you can assess what you want your motivation to be and then make actions which are asymmetric to another player who has the same tools, the same information.
Yeah.
And so I want designers to think about these terms, both of these, not just in terms of genre, but in terms of, like, how you can design a game to work this way. Civilization, when we play Civilization as a group, we're all playing on the same team. So we play with a rule set, which is simultaneous turns. So we're not wasting each other's time, basically. You can play correspondence style, where it's just one player after the other. It takes forever, but it's fair, right?
Yeah.
But we just all entered a joint war against Montezuma, that jerk. And we're all fighting. And there's an example from yesterday when we were playing. We were all fighting in one city. And and this is cement. We're all playing at the same time. We're all playing our turn at the same time. But we've generally we talk on chat. We say, oh, you move here, then I'll move there. So it's turn-based. It's just, it's fluid. But I was saying, hey, I want this city that that we're all fighting. Can I claim it for my civilization? And generally, everyone's like, okay, that sounds fine. But we're playing simultaneous turns. So if we wanted to be internally competitive, whoever clicks it first, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, Dale clicked it first.
Right. I remember that moment too. I think we all had come to the realization. Well, maybe Dale was a little bit faster because she's so good at the game. but like we came to the realization that like we could take over this city. And Dale was like, oh no, I already took it. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, she traded it to me for a barrel of oil, which she desperately needed. So we're fine. It was fine. Those moments are super fun for when we're playing all together because there's no competitive instinct. So we're all just we're all giving each other our goals, and it's a fun low stress time. But what it revealed to me is this idea of like a game that we were essentially playing asynchronously really apart from each other, right? Not exactly asymmetric, but we all working on our own thing. And then when we come together, we had to coordinate our actions. So we had to build the framework for an asynchronous turn structure. But the game itself was like, go ahead and click that city, it's yours. And so I think that's a valuable tool as a designer to like think about those social structures, which change how games can work moment to moment. I don't think that's a design feature of Civilization, but it could be a design feature of your game, you know? Think about player trust as a mechanic and about rules adherence. It's not just for board games. You know what I mean? There's a lot to mine there.
That's really cool. Yeah. Like I guess I don't have a fully fresh thought, idea about like how, what game this could be.
This is not a topic for fully fleshed out thoughts. Don't worry.
Oh yeah. I'm spilling the beans. But like what I'm imagining is like I'm wondering like how that would feel in the moment for a player, like if the player is going through like a turn-based game, but at certain points there are situations where like you and the player have to compete through some form of reflex. Mm-hmm. How would that feel in that moment? As long as that's portrayed to both players equally, how would that feel? Yeah. Like, how would you feel about that?
Well, just because it's been on my mind lately, but the new Paper Mario game, it'll be out by the time, listener, you hear this, in which case the next few episodes might be late because I'll be playing it. but that's a game where that series has always flipped back and forth between real-time elements and turn-based elements. So that's not exactly what you're talking about, but I think it's and that feeling of switching modes, some players really love it. Because it's a flavor of one in the cake of the other, right? Yeah. And it ends up being a richer flavor altogether.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm going for this metaphor, but for other people, it feels discordant, right? Mm-hmm. It's a major scale and then a minor note, you know, like to use another metaphor. And so so that's a case where you really got to survey your players. So, like, who is it for and what are they like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that like Paper Mario has kind of just, I don't know, it kind of just does its own thing.
Yeah.
After a certain point.
You know, I think a lot of an easy example for this, but thinking about like changing these with a synchronous to asynchronous gameplay, putting it in the hands of the player or of multiple players, and like how does that feel, does that align with the ultimate goals of your game design?
Yeah. And what's fascinating about that too, in the Paper Mario example specifically, I only played the RPG versions, I guess they're all RPG-ish.
But quote unquote.
I only played the first two.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that game is like you could theoretically, I don't think anyone does this, but you could play it as a strictly turn-based game where you just press the button, do an attack, Mario walks up to him, hits him with the hammer, walks back, then the Koopa goes in the shell, hits you with the shell or whatever. But the way that game is designed is that every time you do an attack, you can do things to enhance that attack. Like if you're using a hammer attack, you can hold the stick backwards, and then like while Mario will charge up the hammer, when you let go, you deal extra damage,
right?
And then even when Koopa tries to go in a shell and like run at you, you can block it if you do it with perfect timing,
right?
And so like that changes the dynamic of the turn-based gameplay,
and it feels like a bonus. Right. It feels, even though it's a relatively simple mechanic, it feels like you got an extra point.
Yeah.
And so to use it like asynchronous example, think about it like poker, right? Mm-hmm. If let's say we're playing hands of poker, and mm-hmm. I mean, there's no ties in a poker hand, but let's say you're playing a game where the possibility of ties are relatively high.
Yeah.
And it's turn-based, so that when you reveal a tie, then suddenly it's a game of like slap or whatever, where you have, you know what I mean? That feels like a bonus to resolve something like that. So mm-hmm. you can use situations like that to use these as like pepper onto a system. So a game that's designed to be played incredibly slowly, like a by-mail style, like a mobile game, like a Words with Friends or something, you could then introduce mechanics which reward the player who notices something first and acts on it immediately or something like that, right? And that can feel a little bit like you know, I got it, you know, getting away with something or less about like the skill required for, you know, Twitch gameplay or like a fighting game style real time system. Mm-hmm. And it's more about who cares who wins. It's just it's giving someone an extra little bit of joy for being on the ball or something, less than rewarding the reflexes or something. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No, I see where you're coming from. Maybe reflexes wasn't the right word for that, but I see what you're...
It could be, right? This is just an example, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I think that's fascinating. Ah, I love that. I have to think about that, because that could be really cool.
All right. Well, while you're thinking, Ellen, what's on your mind?
I'm also with Steven. I'm thinking. It wasn't really clicking for me until we talked about a little bit about like taking a game that's asynchronous and then like sprinkling in or peppering on some synchronous elements to kind of just like change the pacing for a moment. But that variability in pacing is really important for engagement. And and that is one technique for doing it, is if you have an asynchronous game, work in a moment of synchronicity. And if you have a symmetric game where everyone's got the same options all the time, like I don't know why Halo comes to mind, but you know, like,
Well, class-based systems will do that. It'll give you a bonus in a scenario, or you could tie it to a narrative structure, like two characters with the same abilities, but in a certain situation, their backstories might give them certain abilities that only matter in certain scenarios. And maybe if it's a co-op game, maybe you can gear yourself towards the scenario that matters. You know, you can make that asymmetric elements that are not common. You could work together to leverage them when they need to happen.
When they come up.
Just the main theme here is like, these are not genres, right?
Right. They're just elements and ways that you can structure things that can be interesting. Actually, one just occurred to me about like an asymmetric aspect of Children of Morta, which... Mm. In the last episode, I mentioned, was it this episode?
It was this episode.
Oh my God, it's this episode. It was just several minutes ago mentioned.
That's okay. We're all tired, remember?
With my time, like sense of time so much, but yeah. Anyway, so Children of Morta, like it's a co-op roguelike and you're all playing different characters, right? So I have like roguelikes where you can kind of play as the same character with the same mechanics, even in co-op mode. But there are then these like obelisks around the dungeon. And when you activate an obelisk, it gives everyone in your party, you and your partner, like this time restricted buff. So it's like a timer that runs, it's a buff, then runs out after a minute or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same buff for both of you. So what was happening when we were playing the other night is Eric, my husband, was playing as a tank. So he's in there and he's messing stuff up and hitting stuff. I was playing as archer, so I'm holding way back and moving around and like trying to not be in the thick of things. We got this buff where it was like a damaging aura that was a pulse. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty good. It was doing a lot of damage. So while that was on me, I was running in and just pulsing things to death instead of using my
pulse.
Right.
So it changed my gameplay.
Yeah.
And that moment where, you know, up until that point, our abilities and really the core mechanics of each character were completely different, that for that minute they were similar.
Right. Suddenly there was symmetry. Yeah that's fantastic.
Suddenly there was symmetry. It was pretty fun. And then like there are other, I mean, there are lots of different obelisk power-ups and things like that, and they're all based on time. So it really just it's a fun way to change the pacing and change the experience from minute to minute.
What I love about that example is I think the ones that Steve and I were thinking of is like the boring version, the symmetric or synchronous, peppered with the novel part, right? The A of it, right? But you're describing the opposite. It's and it's just as interesting.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dang, that's really cool.
We'll have to work this into our next Nice Games Jam.
We will have to, yeah.
Oh, boy.
That's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. If you like this episode, give us a review on your favorite podcast app and tell your friends. Independent podcasts like ours rely on your word of mouth to grow. We love hearing from our listeners. So for a quick way to give us feedback on the show, head over to nicegames.club/feedback and fill out a short little form. That's my favorite sentence in the entire outro.
Yeah.
Short little form. False. Actually, the best sentence is this one that's coming up. You can also get in touch with your nice hosts on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and nunchuck wielding bears. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Ask us questions, suggest topics, or just say hello.
And so, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Steven, did I do a good transition?
That's good. Thanks.
Thanks.
This is now the this yeah. Okay.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Granger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.